This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
At the end, it's a question of how, it's the entrepreneurial question of how you deal with risk. And can you minimize your risk exposure? Can you find out what the limitations is? That's the basic job of every consultant and every designer if he looks at business questions. What are the risk questions behind it? Now, doing a Michelin restaurant in itself is a very risky business.
Hello and welcome to Bringing Design Closer on This Is HCD. Our goal is to have conversations that inspire and help move the dial forward for organizations to become more human-centered in their approach to solving complex business and societal problems. I'm Jerry Scullion. I'm the founder of This Is HCD. I'm a designer, educator, design coach, and podcaster based in the wonderful city of Dublin, Ireland. Now, earlier this year, I attended a conference in Nuremberg called Teaming with AI, run by my good friends Marcus Edgar Hormez, Adam Lawrence from Workplay Experience, and also today's guest, Florian Bailey. Now, the day before the event, myself and Florian spent some time together and hung out and explored the office where he was based. In passing, Florian mentioned that he was also co-founder of Etz, a two-star Michelin restaurant. Now, I actually thought he was joking, but no, one of his businesses was the most incredible restaurant, Etz. And the reason why I thought he was joking was I've watched those documentaries just on how demanding these types of restaurants and businesses can be. And I knew Florian was already super busy with his user-centered strategy business and Nuremberg Festival as well that he's really, really involved with. Now, the next day at the event, Etz provided all the food. Now, the food was extremely special, but that wasn't the bit that I was most interested in. I was interested in the journey that Florian and his co-founder went on to get to this point. I mentioned that I'd walked around the office space with Florian before. Well, this is the same space that Marcus and Adam and Mark also use for their amazing This Is Service Design Doing workshops from time to time. But it's also the same space that Florian used to test the prototype for the restaurant. So where was the line of visibility? Where was the line of interaction? And I wanted to drill a little deeper into these areas and learn more about that journey. What worked, what didn't work, etc. So if you're looking for an awesome example of a world-class business that utilizes service design methods, look no further. Now, I work in these episodes as a labor of love, and I love sharing the work of others, and I know many of you enjoy it too, so I see all those wonderful reviews on Spotify and Google. And really, if you want to help me and This Is HCD, maybe you might consider becoming a patron. It's just under €2 a month. You get a premium feed with no ads. It helps me meet the cost of producing everything. So we're still miles away from doing that, so check more at thisishcd.com. But anyway, let's jump straight into this episode. Florian Bailey, I'm delighted to have you here on the podcast. A very warm welcome. Maybe start off, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and where you're from.
I'm from Nuremberg, and I do a lot of things. It's complicated.
You do.
My LinkedIn biography says I'm a designer by trade and craft. Yeah. But I think I'm doing a lot of different things at the same time. A Michelin star restaurant, which is the thing you found most attractive, understandably.
Oh, well, apart from your wonderful hairstyle and the event that we connected with through Marcus and Adam teaming with AI. But would you say entrepreneur? Is that a phrase that you repel, or is it a word you kind of find yourself?
I'm fine with it. And it's not my, when we had the event where you also joined the Teaming with AI event, there were groups of people and there was an entrepreneur group.
Oh, was there?
Yeah, there were people who weren't willing to, or weren't sure what they actually do in their job. And when you looked at them and talked to them later, these were all entrepreneurs and CEOs from companies and something.
CEO on their own.
Yeah. And I joined the innovation and designers group. So I see myself more as a designer and more somebody working on innovation.
Yeah.
In reality, I'm an entrepreneur because I like to do it all. So,
yeah, but we were speaking earlier there, and also in Nuremberg as well, we were talking a little bit about Etz, the restaurant, which we're going to talk a little bit about more about, because how it all came about, I'm really interested in, and also the service design methodologies. Marcus was very proud when he told me that they used cardboard to prototype the space. Cardboard, Jerry. And I was like, okay, brilliant, okay, you know, no, cardboard. And I was like, okay, I get it. Okay, I get it. It was a prototype first. So what I want to know a little bit more about is how you came about working as a designer. You said you identify as an innovation person and a designer. How did you make that first leap into something that might be seen as an extension or a little bit of a step away from what might be seen as conventional or accepted for a designer to do, like your first business that was outside of that realm?
I think the first business, so we started as I was freelance for a long time and did a lot of design consulting and mostly on digital products.
Yeah.
And then there came a shift when we started to more and more events in the regional. So regional events about digitalization, about design, about everything that came up. And sometimes I just did events because I didn't want to travel to Berlin or fly somewhere else internationally.
You say so, events, you mean like conferences and stuff?
Yeah, I went to a lot of events and conferences. And then we just saw communities around here where we said, wow, this is actually a globally relevant community. Like we have Adidas here, Puma, and a lot of research institutes and health and technology. So why don't they meet actually up? Why is there no meetup for them? And I wasn't actually part of these communities, but then I just started a meetup for them just because I thought that will be interesting and interesting insights. Yeah. And then this meetup started and started going and more people came. And then I started another meetup and another meetup for another community. And so suddenly we had like, I think 10, 12 different events going on in the area and with different communities. And we shared these events. So it was like a crowdsourced events. And somebody took over for every event. And then we came up with the idea, well, let's do a little festival for the region and put all the events in 1 week.
Yeah.
And just in an open crowdsourced way. So not in we are doing a festival and we have all the events. Like, let's more build a brand, be more visible for all the events, build visibility for the events, but don't, let's not control it.
Yeah.
And that's when we started the festival in the region. So it was a Nuremberg Digital Festival. Mm-hmm. And that was the first business where I went outside of my usual areas. And it's a very interesting experience because it's so different to other festivals or other event types because it's completely crowdsourced.
Yeah,
we never know what's going to happen, and there's now a professional team managing it. It's 5 people or 6 people. It's still a small business, but it has a lot of. It's an impact business, and we have 400 events in some years, and
it's still pretty impressive.
1,000 organizations and companies that somehow participate as speakers, making their own events, partnering with other organizations to make an event. So what you're building is like a huge, enormous networking cluster and through the whole society. And then you have local theaters doing something with IT companies. And you can watch how new networks appear and new ways how people connect.
And subgroups.
And subgroups. And it's very interesting because you have no control. So it's not much of a business that can scale in a classical sense because we have no control. We can't invite bigger speakers and then becomes a big event or something because it's so different and so driven by the crowd and the interests of all the attendees. Mm. And on the other hand, that makes it pretty unique in what it is delivering for the local network and the community.
So that work that you're doing for the community, you're kind of bringing people together, forming networks. How and what has that given you in terms of what you're bringing forward to the table with ETS? Like, what have you learned from the Nuremberg Festival that you can carry forward into, because I know it's very local, and it's sustainable, and the practices that we like to talk about on this podcast, you're living and breathing on a day-to-day basis with ETS. What have you learned from both running both of those businesses?
There's one thing that is, what the festival gave me is a deeper view and another perspective on ecosystems.
Yeah.
And that's a very complex thing that we usually have problems with. It's not something in a, let's call it in a classical organizational principle. It's not hierarchical. It's not something you can control, an ecosystem. You can try to nourish it. You can try to help it to grow. And that's a principle we also have in the restaurant. Because you, as a restaurant, even if you do a lot of your own stuff, you're still part of an ecosystem of producers, of farmers, of a fishery we're working with. And you impact them not just in what you are buying, you're also impacting them in what you could buy, how you work with them, so they can change their methods and their practices and what they're farming, and also how you buy it. So a restaurant usually is like the final consumer, you know, just buys the finished stuff and says, I take that, I won't take that. And I think where we are going is different. So it's more about the relationship and growing and farming and developing new tastes together.
Okay.
So even from a business perspective, so we as a restaurant now, we are prepaid. Yeah. So you buy your ticket for your reservation in October or November. That, of course, changes our financial model. And it allows us to order stuff now that's still getting produced.
That's awesome. Like, I love that idea of prepaying in the future. So tell me what that means. Like, because some people might say, well, I don't really get that. Tell me what that small change of repositioning where money enters the conversation, what does that give you? As a restaurant owner, and how does that trickle down to the other people as part of your ecosystem?
We can let's say we know how many of our we use Mangalitsa pigs, so it's a very old breed stock that's more or less three groups that are living near a forest around here. And there's one farmer who keeps them. For him, we are like, it's more or less our pigs, because there's not a relevant number of other customers. So what we can do now is to say we need four pigs next year, and we can prepay that. And that changes the way he works and the way he can structure his business and keeps these pigs alive. And these are a dying breed.
Yeah, so do you share in the risk as well? Like, what happens if
there's a
disease amongst the pigs and they die?
We share the risk.
Share the risk and, as well.
Yeah, and that's a change, and a big change. And the same thing happens with, let's say, one of the things we are working with a lot is climate change. So Northern Bavaria, Franconia, where we are, is feeling some very strong effects on climate change. We have a lot of vineyards, and it's getting a lot of drier, and there's more heat. And at the same time, we still have snow and ice days, so a lot of pressure on the ecosystem. And there are some new plants we can bring in that have a higher chance of surviving in these changes. But for farmers, there's a big risk. You're starting with a new plant. You don't actually have any consumer or restaurants buying these plants. So what we can do is, hey, try to farm with these plants with us together. We will buy them from you. We are in a partnership now. So what we, that's something we also want to foster, a partnership to develop for us at the end. It's new taste. Mm. It's something sustainable, locally produced. And for the farmer, it's a new way of doing business. Or let's say he wants to have a farm with an ancient breed. That's usually, that's a high risk, but we can say we will take 50% of this field next year.
Okay.
In that moment, his perspective is completely different. It's suddenly a chance with little risk.
it's really clever in many ways, but from the farmer's perspective, are there other customers like yourselves that work with them in that way as well? So is there potential there for conflict with other customers on his side that may want 70% and they want one of those pigs that died? And what does that look like? No, there's not. So you have that exclusive relationship.
Yeah, and he has the chance to do more. So he can have a second field because he knows how to work with what he's working with. So this is a chance to develop like new opportunities. And on the other hand, you can always go and say, hey, I'm selling these salads to Yetz. And open new opportunities with other restaurants. We have no exclusivity in there. We want to help bring some sustainability and some change into the ecosystem and force and help the ecosystem to in a more sustainable way. And also in a way where, let's say, the things that the market usually doesn't want are priced in a different way and valued in a different way. So, I mean, what the market wants is things that can be packaged, that are standardized. The things we want are like the opposite of that. And if we can give more financial security in that range for our partners, then they have a chance to develop more in that area.
Yeah. So by the time it hits the plate in Etz, though, it's usually going to be quite different. Is that right? So like if you're taking a plant that nobody wants, people may not have the same sense of value or sense of vision and what you can potentially do with that. So you must have something happening magical in between the farm and the plate. And I'm really keen to understand that process. You know, we realize the quality of the ingredients is obviously extremely important, if not the most important thing. But from my understanding of brief conversations with Marcus and Adam and yourself, and also tasting the food from Etz and somewhat at the event, something special is brewing, and especially if you're getting 2-star Michelin restaurant happening. What are the ingredients that you've helped foster and the team helped foster on a day-to-day basis in terms of the principles and how you operate?
There are some very strong ideas that Felix, the head chef, and my partner use to develop the culinary style of the Etz. And the basic principle is focusing on a local and sustainable ingredients and producers, not in a very clearly defined way. So there's no 30 kilometers, 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers border. It's more about having a relationship with the people and the ecosystem you work with. And the other principle is looking at things differently. So working with them from the beginning. Not accepting pre-made stuff. Looking at the principle behind it and what is possible. So there's an interesting story behind it, how the restaurant became what it is now. It's a 6 to 7, 8 year learning process. So when they started, to buy these old pig breeds, they couldn't find anybody to tell them how to work with them. So they had to, the kitchen team had to learn everything by themselves, teach themselves, fail and fail again, how to do their own, how to cut these. And what the restaurant is now doing is that we don't get any deliveries that are not raw. So what we get is the produce. We get, and what's happening is we are no longer a kitchen. We are no longer a restaurant. We are more like a small local artisan craft factory working with all these products. So we have, so one day they ask themselves, couldn't we buy local sugar? And it's an interesting question. And they looked at their organic sugar in the, and they were, and it wasn't local, because sugar is traded in a global and a national way. So it's very hard, especially in Germany, to buy local sugar. So they looked at it, couldn't buy any. It was organic, but not local. And then, but in the area, you have a lot of sugar beets that are actually harvested. So everybody asked them, why don't we have local sugar? And then they started to buy the beets and make their own sugar.
So and now you have your own sugar.
Yeah, we have our own sugar. So we still buy something, and now there are some producers who produce local sugar. So there's always an inspiration process going on. But you start to make your own sugar, and then you get melasse, and you get other other facts out of these beets, not just sugar, not just the end product. And then you get, suddenly you notice that there are different ways this tastes depending on how you work with it in the artisan process of making sugar out of beets. And then you kind of ripen them a bit longer, or you put them in the cold. And so by going a step backwards and looking at the whole process, you discover different ways of taste and different ways of working with these products. And suddenly you have a much bigger, you're not no longer working with sugar, you're working with 20 different ways of producing sugar and 20 different tastes. And suddenly you can have a dessert that is only made of these beets and some other components, and but has 20 different kinds of tastes for sugar in there. And that's kind of...
Yeah, it is a kind of a mindset, so to speak, of how you're approaching the whole process. It's not just the process of when it hits the kitchen. It's the process that the benefits that come with all of those other pieces. For people listening who might see themselves as designers as well, who have interests in business and interest and impact and wanting to apply some of the stuff that they're interested in, one of the big blockers would be access to capital, to get land, to get a restaurant and stuff. How was this problem tackled amongst yourselves at Etz? Because I know the designers and the change makers that listen to this podcast are perfect listeners who have got the potential there to really make situations an awful lot better by bringing these kind of sensibilities to the business world. What advice do you give to those people on how you approached the most common blocker in starting a business? It's access to capital.
Access to capital is always a question of risk. So at the end, it's a question of how, it's the entrepreneurial question of how you deal with risk. And can you minimize your risk exposure? Can you find out what the limitations is? That's the basic job of every consultant and every designer, if he looks at business questions. Absolutely. What are the risk questions behind it? Now, doing a Michelin restaurant in itself is a very risky business. There's no question. I wouldn't advise it.
You heard it here. There is the soundbite for the podcast. I would not advise this. I'm sure that's not always true.
No. What we did is when we started this, so Felix already was head chef in another restaurant he didn't own. So we are owning the ads together now. So, and he developed a lot of the techniques we're using now there. So there was already the basic and the theory and how the craft was already there. What we noticed in the process is that there's a much more potential to do more products. So you have a kitchen that does their own vinegar, their own soy sauce, their own flavors and ferments things for 1 year. So we have 30 barrels of different sauces fermenting for 1 year in the kitchen. So you have to come by in our test kitchen. It's not a test kitchen anymore. It's 600 square meters of fermentation products, ripening, drying. And so this is more like a very big lab and factory.
Mm.
And in this, we saw, when we started the ads, we just saw the opportunity to, can we sell some of this stuff?
So, yeah.
Because a Michelin restaurant is an attention getter and something that builds the brand and the visibility. If we get the experience right and can communicate what we are actually doing, and so we are just building an e-commerce business out of it, not to actually become a big e-commerce business, because that's not the goal in this case, but just to make it more stable and de-risk it at the same time.
So balance out the business model. Yeah. One of the things that I want to ask you about, you said it's about 6 or 8 years old. Etz, is it?
The technique and the craft. So we started the ads 2 years ago.
Yeah. But you started working on it 8 years ago.
In a way. So Felix and the other restaurant started to shift to a more sustainable story. Mm. That was the so sign, and developed a lot of the techniques we are using now. And in the last 3 years, we had a lot of refinement and going even deeper with a bigger garden now and our big test kitchen.
That's insane. So how if you've been open 2 years and now you're telling me you're a 2-star Michelin restaurant, people like myself, all we know that about the Michelin star process is from looking at Netflix and looking at restaurant documentaries and recently The Bear. If anyone hasn't listened, watched The Bear on Apple.
Great TV, series. Great.
It's absolutely, it's a killer episode or killer series. So the quality and the dedication that goes into that. If you're telling me you got a 2-star Michelin restaurant after 2 years, what was that journey? How did you go about it? Did you just send them an email saying, hey, lads, I'll give you some money? Or that's a joke.
No. They knew Felix and the team, and they said, there's something new going on, and then they're coming. It was still quite a struggle because we had a pop-up restaurant for the first year because our final location wasn't there yet. So
I'm pouring a coffee here, folks. Go on ahead.
So talking about de-risking, we weren't very good at that. We had a pop-up location first and an old butchery in northern Nuremberg that we used as a test kitchen. That's actually where we found the name. So it was Metzgerei. It's a butcher in Germany. And Etz is also the Franconian word for now.
Oh.
And it's used very colloquially in like, can you do that now? Or no, I don't know. So it's a very local word, and it was in the sign already included.
Okay. So
we took it from there.
So you've saved a couple of thousand on the sign. Is what you're telling me.
That was just safe.
Like, give me the Tippex.
And
more Tippex. It's a big sign.
So we were in the pop-up first, and so we had, and we got 2 stars for the menu in the pop-up already, which makes us the only 2-star catering that has ever existed, because we had to prepare the menu in the old butchery and drive over to the pop-up location, which was more like a show kitchen, and drive back after the service. And next day again and again and again. So, and after some months, the team and Felix said, I could do this anywhere now. So we are like there for some months. We had the only 2-star catering service in the world.
It's a remarkable story. One of the bits that I want to chat to you a little bit more around, they'll probably be listening. And if we don't mention the story of the prototype and how you got to this point, because when you look at the photos, and I have not been at Etz, the restaurant itself, although I just want to say publicly, Florian invited me and my wife to Nuremberg and my entire family. And all my friends and all the listeners to this restaurant for free, folks. Disclaimer, it was just me and my wife. But when you look at this, there's I want to talk about the process of the selection of the lighting. It's something that really struck me instantly. It seems to be very carefully selected, okay, which is no surprise, because if anyone has been listening to this episode for the last half an hour or so, everything seems to be well thought out and very structured. But the line of visibility, for anyone who's interested in blueprints, and the line of interaction, I guess, as well, is kind of very transparent. Mm-hmm. Walk me through how you design the experience, because you're speaking to a designer and a restaurateur and an entrepreneur, bringing these kind of ingredients, these ingredients together has lend itself to this wonderful culinary experience. So walk me through what that process was like, and did Felix, I think is the name of the head chef, what was Felix's take on this, on using the Nuremberg studio to prototype the layout?
It's a very interesting thing, because the prototype at the end was a prototype where we learned a lot and a lot that we couldn't use. So when we started, we had some general ideas from the last restaurant and, of course, from the and I think cafes and restaurants are always appealing for a designer, because we have so much interaction with it. We see it and we see the process, and that makes it, even if you're not a foodie, very appealing, because you're thinking about the process, you're watching it, and you think, how can you optimize it? And what's going wrong here? Yeah. So, and the other side is, it's a very experience-driven process where all touch points matter in a way. And it's not even the marketing touch point that matters, because even if you get the marketing right, but the experience sucks, you're not going to come back.
Expectancy. We talk about the pre and the service and the post-service experience.
Yeah. And it's not something where you can just sell it and then have a running business. It's not it's not a weird Kickstarter gizmo that you sell for one time. So that all came, these experiences, we actually collected these experiences, and we actually looked at the 100 top restaurants in the world, how they were structured, how the experience for the guest differed.
So how did you do that? I was going to say, please tell me you got budget from somewhere to fly around the world and eat in the top 100 restaurants.
Of course, you're a foodie and you like that area, so you've been into 5 or 10 of them. But the others we collected from friends, from others who were there, and what their experience was. I actually looked at every photo I could find and every description of the process. So we did a lot of desk research,
Instagram,
so to speak, and really try to structure the journey. How do the people find out of the restaurant? What's the first moment when they arrive? And then it was very easy to see where restaurants have an exceptional experience in one of those journey moments. So you have something like the Cooks on the Faroe Islands. It's a very small Nordic cuisine restaurant. And they have an exceptional experience when your evening starts, because you drive somewhere out on the Faroe Island, and then they get you from a shed with Land Rovers and drive you to the restaurant. And so your experience starts like several hundred meters before you arrive at the restaurant. So you have these different levels of experience. And then you have the classic restaurants where you just walk into the door and somebody stops you and say, hey, who are you? Which is not cool. And so we try to look at all these experience levels. Yeah, something like the Noma in Copenhagen, where you walk through the garden and get some tea first in the greenhouses and arrive.
For people who are interested in this, this is Adam that wrote a great article about the boom, 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 wow, boom, which is, you know, the dramatic arc piece within journey maps, and you can include them in blueprints, I guess, if you wanted, but really that whole kind of big wow moment at the start. How are you tackling that at ETS? Like, what is there a boom at the start?
Yeah. And that's an interesting, we didn't use Adams, but we actually thought very much about these boom moments. And one thing we noticed in the old restaurant, and interestingly in the feedback from the pop-up. So the pop-up for us was also a prototype.
Yeah.
So we had several levels of prototype. We had the cardboard prototype, which was very interesting because the cardboard prototype for us was, I'm going to try to go into these prototypes for a moment because I think that's important to understand where we got our data from and for the final design.
Yeah.
So we had the old restaurant where Felix was the head chef. So the cuisine and the approach to sustainable cuisine was already on a top level there. But the experience for the guests was very classic. So you sit on a table and you see nothing from the kitchen. And you have a very nice dinner and you leave. And what I noticed when I talked to guests who were there is that they didn't understand what was happening. So even if the kitchen team came out and talked to them, they left and they didn't understand that these animals were bought whole and we worked with these farmers to raise these animals and we dry them and work with them with that meat for 1 year, or that everything they had on their plate was done by the team themselves. Mm. Nothing was bought. They didn't understand that. And that made the experience completely different.
Yeah.
Because it's a very nice, interesting tasting plate, but you don't see the story behind it. So one thing we took out of the old restaurants, we have to show the story in an emotional way. They have to feel it. We need to make the process more visible and open the kitchen up. So that was the decision for an open kitchen.
So how do you explain the narrative of the journey? Obviously, you're busy enough as it is, and they can't plonk you at the table for 20 minutes at every sitting and kind of go, we actually work with the farmer for a year.
So what we do now and what we plan now and where the experience is going now is that the evening starts with a tea in the test kitchen.
Okay.
So the guests come in on a big table. On the table is the menu, are some of the produce we use in the menu of the season. Because we have these micro seasons and the menu changes every week depending on what nature gives us, which is very stressful. But you have this welcome in the test kitchen where one of the chefs explains something about some produce we're using at this moment, about the barrels behind you, about the tastes that are developing here and the way we work. So your experience actually starts with 20 minutes of a deep dive into the test kitchen. But from an experience level, it's not like somebody explains something. It's a very emotional moment. You're behind. Yeah, there are a lot of restaurants who talk about how transparent they are. And it's a lot of show. Let's be honest about it. You can go to the restaurant I just mentioned, the Noma, and they say, this is our greenhouse with herbs. And you walk into the greenhouse and it's like 12 square meters. And you think like you have how many hundred guests per week? It's a beautiful greenhouse. I have nothing against this greenhouse, but you know.
Does it really produce enough for thousands and thousands and thousands of guests?
there's another restaurant, and I don't want to call names, that says, oh, please, we are, yeah, CeeLo in London.
Okay.
Yeah, a brilliant restaurant, and I really want to go there. But they talk a lot about how they are a zero waste restaurant and use the bottles from the wine bottles to produce cutlery and everything else and plates. Now, that's a very nice idea. I know how many bottles of wine we sell per week. So, and since they don't have a side business selling plates, I very much doubt. So
it pays to be a bit cynical about some of these things, folks. Don't just accept the information that it's.
We had the story in the US where on the island near Seattle, where the restaurant was telling the story about that they produce everything on the island. And it's a bit like the movie. It's not possible that they produce everything on the island because the island is too small. So that makes no sense. Huh? Yeah. So and by starting in the test kitchen, we give people a feeling of honesty and transparency that you usually don't have, because you're actually looking at our storage areas. You're actually looking at everything we have in there. And so you're really
in the open.
We're totally transparent in that moment. And on the other hand, you have so many flavors in the room. And these are not the refined flavors you will have later. This is the rough density, the umami you're smelling, the richness of the fermentation process in that room. And you get a tea.
Yeah.
And you just arrive in that moment. And that's the first bang.
I remember we stayed... And this is not a flex, by the way, because you've far and away, you know, got so many more culinary experiences. But on our honeymoon, we got married in Italy 10 years ago, folks, myself and my wife. And
congratulations.
it's in a couple of months. But we stayed at a place called Monastero Santa Rosa in near Positano. And when we went in, I realized I'd left my passport in the previous hotel in Sorrento, and I was like freaking out. I was like, because we were flying back to Australia in a few days after that, and they're like, sir, please don't worry about it, we'll find that and bring it to you. And I'm like, what, how are you going to do that? You don't know where the hotel was. And he goes, no, we'll find it, don't worry, just come to our balcony and have some tea that we freshly picked from your garden. And I'm like, what? So I was so Irish. I was literally like that moment of like giving me tea in my hand, relaxing me. And it was a first boom experience that I've ever had in my life in terms of like they designed this. They didn't want me freaking out about my passport. And they said, just meet us back here in 3 hours and we'll have it for you. And sure enough, they sent a car to get it and they came back with my passport. Like, you know, but it's that level of detail that they really considered, the tea in the hand, looking at the Mediterranean, to calm your mind, like, you know. So it's really, really interesting. Can I ask you a question? And feel free to say no to this one, but what's been the biggest failure and what have you learned from it in opening Etz? And I know you're instantly, whenever I say this to some guests, they're like, no, I'm gonna have to show some vulnerability. What's been, because for me, you know, it sounds like everything is working and everything is working to plan. And you know, and I know from a design perspective, the real lesson is in the failure. So if you can tell me something around this whole experience, primarily around Etz, in terms of what that failure was and what did you learn from it? Agreeing to this podcast.
No. But it's really, the thing is, the way the kitchen team works is something that inspires me in my work every day, because they work with a way of limitation.
Yeah,
they define the way and the limitations of the work before they start working.
Tell me more about this.
So Felix and the team says, no, we are going to use only local produce.
Yeah, so they're locked down. They've got some restriction.
They have a restriction. Then they decide, we are only going to do it on our own. We are not going to have something pre-made from somebody. So we are going to do it on our own, even if we don't know how.
Yeah.
So, and then we are going to learn that. And then we are going to try to be as sustainable as we can. And then you just talked about the work environment, a bit of Michelin restaurant, how it is. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of bad stories out there.
Yeah.
And then we decided we want to be a workplace where people feel included, where they want to work, you know,
yeah.
Where that's a different way of working at that level. And that's why we have only 3 evenings open
a week. Okay.
Yeah. And then we have 1.5 days where we prepare everything and people are in the kitchen. And so this changed our way, but this also changed the business perspective.
Yeah.
And so my job in a way is to match the experience and these core ideas with a business perspective and make it work. Mm. Now these principles and working from these principles and still managing to work from these principles is something that inspires me every week. So I'm sitting in there and they have to design a new menu for the next week because the blue flowers are gone. I can't collect any more blue flowers. So what are we going to do? Are we going to use the white flowers? But the white flowers have a different taste. So we have to change this plate for the next week slightly. And we have to do this all on a level of 2-star, of a 2-star Michelin restaurant, because one bush of white flowers is no longer available. And that's something that happens every week, working in designing plates and experiences every week in the limitations that are there and still make them exceptional every week. So I'm having a hard time talking about failures, because what I learned from them is to accept the process.
Yeah.
And just our e-commerce launch just now was a bit weird, and we had the box was too big and the price too high and should have gone.
Adapting.
Huh?
You're always adapting, and it sounds to
I'm
me
adapting.
Like micro failures.
Absolutely. So
all
it's
the time.
Absolutely, every day. So we adapt and we change it. And that's something I'm really learning from the team, to accept, to accept these irregularities. And these are just part of the flow. And this exceptional quality you get is by learning, adapting.
Yeah.
And so I'm having a hard time with the term failure now, because the experience we have now is very much formed by these different prototypes, by the pop-up restaurant, where we learned a lot about lighting, about the emotional experience over an evening, over a real service. But we knew it was just for a time and it was a prototype. So we actually logged experiences and what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah.
And the cardboard prototype was at first only for the butchery, this very small space. And we didn't know, can we fit a restaurant in there? And we couldn't.
Yeah.
But what we learned when doing the cardboard real size prototype, so we built a complete kitchen, we built the seatings for everybody. And what we learned is about the relationship between the chefs in an open kitchen and the people sitting on the other side. And we learned how hate and if the seating is a bit lower and everything changes the atmosphere and the emotional experience of hierarchy, of openness, of the relationship between the chefs and the guests completely. So these prototypes didn't actually give us what we wanted. We just wanted an easy answer how the restaurant should look like.
Yeah.
But they gave us insights. They gave us insights in how open should be the kitchen. How can we design the relationship between the chefs and the guests? How can we improve the experience? And so all of these different aspects came into the final design. And then we gave it to a very good architect interior designer and said, look, this is what we learned. Can you design this? So we didn't go in there and try to be the interior designer, because honestly, I'm not. So, and Felix is not. But we took all our insights to him and said, this is what we want from you. Can you design the experience in this way? And these are the limitations we see from the experience and from the prototypes. And that's actually what he did then. And then we had a very strict time frame, Florian, because we had to leave the pop-up. And Florian. But the experience with the prototypes and the Florian. Planning process gave him a very clear view. And I think you can see that in the restaurant and the lighting and everything else. Built a very clear briefing and a very clear setting to work on. As a designer, it definitely influenced how we work with that. It's not a 3D design space. It's actually a space designed on service design and prototyping, based on prototypes and service design. It's not something built in a 3D program. So it looks nice. It's built for, so the experience for every guest is exceptional. And every guest has an exceptional perspective, and every guest feels the openness of the space and the non-hierarchy to the chefs. So, and that's actually the feedback we get for the space and how we work now. So even up to Google reviews we get, it feels so open and you feel like you are part of something in a space, and that's unique. So if your service designer wants to take up the restaurant baton and run with it, go for it and prototype it and go for it to develop that experience and focus on that and not on the 3D program, good-looking restaurant coffee experience.
Can I ask you a question before we wrap up? How do you manage your time? Okay, because I know you're a dad, you've got a Nuremberg digital festival, teaming with AI, ETS, and these are the ones that I know about, and I'm sure there's other ones there as well. What's your role in ETS, and do you have a set day a week or something, or is it just a case of like your phone blows up when you wake up in the morning? How are you managing this?
No, it'll have an impact. I try to.
It'll catch up with you.
I try actually to build. I'm still struggling with it. I think it would be dishonest to say I have the perfect system. You know, like a weird LinkedIn post. I wake up and then I.
Yeah. So, I have my coffee and meditate for 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Right now,
you know, I'm very healthy.
No one has a journal.
So no.
Only that Instagram post that keeps on getting served to me.
Yeah, it's like I always try this for another 2 days every year. I try to, and that's something I learned over the last years. As a designer, I need the different experiences actually for myself, so my head works. So I try actually to change places a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I have the consultancy office where I'm currently in,
yeah,
where I'm on 2 days a week, and I'm 1 day a week I work from the restaurant, even if I do some consultancy business. That gives me a totally different perspective again. And 1 day a week, I try to work from Munich or Berlin with our other partners there or clients. So, of course, this is just like an idealized week. So, it fails in 50% of all cases, at least. But I try to change places and give places a meaning by working on something specific at that place.
Okay.
I don't know if this is something that can be adapted to other people, but I noticed that it helps me
focus,
feel and get differently inspired by specific things. And you all know how you have good days in a week and bad days in a week.
Yeah.
And Mondays are usually not the best days in the week,
yeah,
at least for me personally. I'm trying to solve that by being in Berlin or Munich. I'm on my way and meeting a lot of people, and that gives me a lot of energy. And then I work on more consultancy stuff on Tuesday, and on Wednesday I'm in the restaurant. And so my overall impact over a week is different.
Okay. So a lot of it's being physically present and connected to the work at a deeper level versus
to the people.
Yeah. Sit in the same space to do a podcast, to do a coaching session. That would make sense, and it would be ideal to be able to meet people where they're at as often as possible. But you segregate and you sort of segment your time in a very intentional way to be present, I guess. That's what I'm hearing.
That's what I'm trying.
Yeah, that's what you're trying.
Of course, it often fails, but let's say it this way. On weeks when it works, I feel brilliant. Yeah. So, at least I know what I'm struggling for.
Yeah. So, if people can accept the whole kind of, I'm only here for one day, and then if you need me again, I'm here next week, that's great. But it tends to be that whole kind of bleeding nature of.
Of course. And then you get a call, and then you have something else going on. And I'm really struggling with it sometimes. And the other part is having partners you can trust.
Yeah.
So here in the consultancy, I work with exceptional people where I have a lot of trust, who my partner in the restaurant, Felix, is, in my personal opinion, the most exceptional chef you can.
Yeah.
Meet anywhere, definitely in Germany, probably one of the most exceptional chefs internationally. He has values, is like a microbiologist and a chef all in one person. This is a very rare combination.
Yeah.
You have these people, and then you have to trust these people. You can't do it alone. I have one role, and that's as the creative head, the strategic head, and the experience head, so to speak.
Mm.
But I can't design every detail of the experience. I need to
work with others,
leave room and trust their impact. A lot of how I'm working now is actually inspired by working with the restaurant team.
Mm-hmm.
Their appreciation of, there's a farmer and he does differently. Why do you do things differently? Is there something we can learn from that for the way we work with your produce?
Yeah.
This openness for the ecosystem.
Yeah.
This is really something I'm learning a lot, much more than I thought. I thought I just living the foodie dream and building the restaurant of my dreams, but it changed the way I work.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. It sounds it. Florian, I've thoroughly enjoyed peeking inside your brain for 45, 50 minutes. I'm going to put a link to, obviously, the Etz restaurant or Etz restaurant into the show notes of this episode, folks. Whenever I get back to Nuremberg, I will accept that offer. Yeah. Trust me, I will. And I'd love to see how we can promote it in any shape or form, because the level of detail, both ethically and sustainably, is just mind-blowing. And I remember Marcus and Adam telling me about you, like maybe about a year ago, about this restaurant and stuff, how it's amazing. So I'm excited to get to it. If people want to reach out and ask questions to you, what's the best way for them to do that? Because I know you've got another business that we didn't even speak about, user-centered strategy. I think it's called Nuremberg. What's it called?
Yeah, it's called Nuremberg Digital Festival. So I'm easy to Google, just Florian Bailey, and send me a Twitter DM or something else. You will easily find me on LinkedIn or somewhere else.
On LinkedIn, absolutely. Florian, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with the audience. Totally enjoyed speaking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
There you go, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you enjoyed it and want to listen to more, why not visit thisishcd.com, where you can learn more about what we're up to and also explore our courses whilst you're there. Thanks again for listening. Thank you.